People have witnessed the academic betrayal in liberalism, where the so-called scholars are the ones who have attacked the Bible. And so people are afraid of that. They say, I don't want to get involved in study. I'm happy with Jesus. But the problem is that if our hearts are going to be on fire, the way God has made us is that the conduit to the heart is the mind. Mindless zeal has no virtue to it whatsoever.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of the White Horse Inn, where we're continuing our Romans Revolution. The first Reformation was about doctrine. The second one needs to be about behavior. Best-selling author Rick Warren told a Congress of the Baptist World Alliance last year, going on to quote him again, "We need a Reformation not of creeds, but of deeds." Throughout the speech, as reported on the group's website, Mr. Warren announced that a new movement is underway in the church, shifting the emphasis from doctrinal issues to service in the world. Quote, "It's time to stop debating the Bible and start doing it. This is the new Reformation I'm praying for," end quote. Now, this isn't a new message, however. In the history of evangelical revivalism, there has always been a running screed against everything formal, creedal, historical, and always been a play for the heart over against the head. At least in the evangelicalism I grew up in, the deeds over creeds speech is pretty familiar. Nearly any crazy fad in the church today can be justified by its success in conjuring emotional passion and zeal for good works, regardless of how quickly and how many victims of these revival fires get burned out in the process. Whatever its problems with Mary and the saints, Protestantism has shown time and again that it is just as capable of building towers of zeal reaching to the heavens in works righteousness. Nobody needs Paul's message here in Romans 10 that we'll be looking at in this program more than we do, and at no greater moment than ours. Zeal without knowledge is our subject in this program of the White Horse Inn, as we continue the Romans Revolution and do so with our usual hosts. The Reverend Dr. Kim Riddlebarger is pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, Lutheran Church Missouri Synod minister, is also professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine. And the Reverend Ken Jones is pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. I'm Mike Horton. I teach theology at Westminster Seminary, California. Gentlemen, a very important passage, and we begin with verse 1 chapter 10, continuing here our trek through Romans. "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they might be saved. I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge, for being ignorant of the righteousness that comes from God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." Let's first of all, starting with that quote I began the commentary with from Pastor Rick Warren, the first Reformation was about doctrine. The second one needs to be about behavior. We need a Reformation not of creeds, but of deeds. Is there this perennial temptation in religion to have zeal without knowledge, to be impatient with doctrine?
There is a perennial temptation because many Christians unfortunately think the Christian faith is essentially about ethics. And if you're trying to grow the church, if your focus is on church growth and expansion in terms of the numbers of people that come to faith, if you want the large, you know, roster every year of all the new names, then you're going to make the highway with as many lanes on it as you possibly can. And the common denominator that all religions and that all religious people have is ethics. Mm-hmm. And so you move away from the distinctives of Christianity and its distinctive doctrines toward the kind of ethical practices that nominal religious people can affirm, Jews can affirm, even some Muslims can affirm, Roman Catholics can affirm, and yes, this broadly evangelical America can affirm. And the temptation is to move away from things that divide to things that unite and what unites is ethics.
So really, gay unions, gay mm-hmm. marriages will bring religious America together a lot more quickly and with a lot greater zeal than, say, the doctrine of the Trinity.
Well,
you
sure.
mean opposing gay marriages and
right.
gay unions.
But of course, you don't have the scandal of the gospel either. I mean, we used to associate this kind of nonsense with liberal Protestantism.
Yeah, that's the roots of this.
I mean, the gospel's gone.
Well, I challenge anyone who makes that claim. In the first place, you're going to have to prove to me that the problem of the evangelical church is too much doctrine.
Secondly, preach it, brother.
Sociologists have made it very clear that evangelicals are not well taught in their doctrine.
And secondly, you're going to also have to prove to me that the emphasis in the evangelical church since the Second Great Awakening hasn't been on ethics and practice. Isn't the moral majority and its failure, that the whole religious right thing, isn't that praxis?
Deeds over creeds?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And didn't that fail?
Yeah, Charles Finney, you refer to the Second Great Awakening. The leader of the Second Great Awakening in many ways was Charles Finney. And he wasn't an Arminian. Don't want to give Arminians a bad name. He was a Pelagian. I mean, he said that...
And not a semi-Pelagian, by the way.
No.
He was full-blown.
Oh, he didn't... Charles Finney denied original sin, justification, substitutionary atonement.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the church is basically a society of moral and social transformers. Finney gave rise to both liberal activism and conservative activism.
Yeah. Jesse Jackson and Jerry Falwell both had the same theological father, and it's Charles Finney.
Yeah. 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 Prohibition was one of the things.
Exactly.
And abolitionism.
Something good came out of it.
Yeah, something good came out of it. Yeah. You had a personal stake in that, actually.
Yeah, literally.
But all kinds of different political positions that are identified either with the left-wing side of the aisle or the right-wing political side of the aisle were all comprehended in this one revivalistic movement that has now split into liberal Protestantism and conservative Protestantism, but it's all basically moralism.
Sure it is. And what doesn't occur to the conservative Protestant church in America is that the devil rejoices in this, the preaching of moralism.
Yeah.
I got to use the illustration that I used before. Donald Gray Barnhouse, the pastor many years ago of 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, said, what would it actually look like if Satan took over a city? And, of course, our minds run to all kinds of things that probably look a lot like our day.
Red light districts.
Yeah, exactly. He said, no, here's what it would look like if Satan took over a town. Be white picket fences. All of the yards would be very clean. There would be no gum on the sidewalks. The children would all say, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir. Their hair would be trimmed. And all of the bars would be closed. There would be no foul language. And everyone would go to church twice every Sunday where Christ is not preached.
That is a great illustration.
It's wonderful.
That's the insidious character of Satan's work.
Well,
and it applies to going to church mm-hmm. where we're going to talk about a recipe for remaking you.
Mm-hmm. And the Bible will be open and used.
Yeah.
Christ just won't be preached from it, or at least not as as the satisfaction of God's wrath, and certainly not as our Redeemer.
This is absolutely parallel to those first five verses in chapter 10. It is.
Absolutely.
I mean, I hear more and more people anymore who have visited evangelical churches. Christ wasn't even mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
I assumed it would be as the moral model to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh. His name doesn't even come up.
Yeah.
It isn't needed.
Yeah.
Or if it is, it's mentioned as role model, as Paul alludes to in 2 Corinthians 11, I think it is, when he speaks of another gospel, another Christ, and another spirit that you have not received. And he's not saying that someone will come in masquerading as Jesus, but simply that Jesus would be preached, but not as the lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world.
No.
Good role model, good leader, good business model.
Remember B.B. Warfield, the famous Princeton theologian, his critique of Charles Finney was interesting. He said, you know, Finney's got this wonderful system of ethics. The problem is he tries to make it theology. It'd be much better if he would take God out of it altogether.
Mm. Yeah.
Just treat it as a secular
natural theology.
Yeah, exactly. Treat it as natural law and you'll be fine. And that's unfortunately what we see going on with Rick Warren's kind of quote. Warren is basically saying we can unite around our practices instead of dividing around our beliefs. Mm-hmm. And so the more you focus on action, and let's say some of the things he's done is wonderful. I mean, the AIDS movement, there are lots of things he's involved in. They're all great causes. They're all wonderful causes. It's just they're not the gospel.
I think that it's something that is true not only of mainstream evangelicalism. This is true of a lot of our churches. We want to transform. It's not that our that the motives are necessarily bad.
Of course.
But it's that we're missing out here the whole emphasis that Paul is placing on the gospel when he says, I know it's counterintuitive because, as we'll see in the next program, law righteousness is intuitive.
Right.
That's what you know.
Right.
And this is not going to be intuitive. How can believing that you do nothing to contribute anything to your salvation possibly create a basis for ethics? Alexander Schweitzer said that there is no basis for any kind of ethics in the doctrine of justification as it was enunciated by the Reformers. Hmm. I mean, this is exactly what Paul himself had as objections. It comes up again and again. People will say, look, you guys think that you have it all wrapped up, it's all in your head, you have all the right doctrine, but you're not living it. And we can actually say, you know what? That is exactly why we need to be very clear about the doctrine so that we know who we can run to because we don't.
Sure.
Well, because you don't either.
Yeah, right. Nobody's living up to it.
Nobody.
Sociologists will tell you if you're going to check empirically on members of churches across the board, it's all about equal if you're going to measure sanctification.
Right.
Not much difference. But didn't Paul give this in a verse in Romans 1 that he was going to talk about a righteousness not according to law?
Mm. Yeah.
Wasn't that in chapter 1?
Already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's sort of an announcement of what I'm going to do.
Yeah. On the line with us is Dr. R.C. Sproul, president of Ligonier Ministries and host of the radio program Renewing Your Mind. R.C., thanks for being with us on the White Horse Inn as we're going through the Romans Revolution.
Well, it's a wonderful thing to be a Palomino among all these white horses. I always get a big charge out of being with you guys on the inn.
R.C., we're currently in chapter 10, and we've arrived at Paul's warning about having zeal without knowledge. You think this is an important warning for us today in the American church?
Oh, no, Mike. I mean, I think today is an unprecedented time of biblical literacy. The church is overflowing with knowledge. Now, our problem today is that nobody seems to have any zeal. And if you believe that, I have some wonderful property down here in Florida that I'd like to sell you. No, I mean, I wonder if there's ever been a time where the church has been had more of a disjunction between knowledge and zeal than is manifest in our country today.
Not too long ago, Brian Chappell, the president of Covenant Seminary in St. Louis, gave us an interesting anecdote. He said that 20 years ago, a third of the incoming seminarians failed the initial Bible exam, showing they needed to take remedial courses. Today, he says, two-thirds, not one-third, but two-thirds, regularly fail that very same exam. What do you think is the cause of this decline in biblical literacy, even among those who are raised in the church, even conservative evangelical churches, and are heading to seminaries?
I'm not sure, Mike. You know, somebody just asked me that yesterday, and I'm sure there are a lot of converging factors that contribute to it, not the least of which is this pervasive sense of relativism in the culture, where people respond to life matters on the basis of personal preferences and feelings. All the accents on relationships, not on doctrine. If you're not interested in a doctrine, why would you read the Bible? Because that's what the Bible is. It's God's revealed truth, and it's content. But we've sort of departed from any concern for content. So that may be one of the reasons. A second reason is going back to the statistics that you just mentioned a moment ago about the men entering seminary in a state of biblical illiteracy, and the seminaries haven't done a whole lot to correct that problem. And when these fellows get out and go into churches, they're afraid to teach the Bible because they don't know it themselves. And so the congregation gets shortchanged. That's another thing. I mean, we've lost expository preaching. You know that as well as I do. But when the preachers are preaching pop psychology, entertainment, current events, what happens to Scripture?
Is Paul saying that we should pit zeal against knowledge, that we should pick the head over the heart?
No, absolutely not. It's that our zeal should be according to knowledge. I mean, God made us with minds. He also made us with hearts. And we know, you know, in the academic world, as I've known, that you can have everything correct in terms of your conceptual understanding of the faith. Your doctrine can be solid and so on, and your heart can be ice cold. And again, people have witnessed the academic betrayal in liberalism, where the so-called scholars are the ones who have attacked the Bible. And so people are afraid of that. They say, I don't want to get involved in study. I don't want to get involved in these things. I'm happy with Jesus. But the problem is that if our hearts are going to be on fire, the way God has made us is that the conduit to the heart is the mind. Mindless zeal has no virtue to it whatsoever.
Hey, Mike Horton here. If you're new to the White Horse Inn and want to know what you believe and why you believe it, be sure to visit our website in order to sign up for a free membership. When you sign up at whitehorseinn.org, you'll get free access to the 12 most recent extended-length episodes, along with discussion questions for each program and terms to learn. And you can get your free membership just by signing up at whitehorseinn.org/member. That's whitehorseinn.org/member.
Well, it's hard to believe, but 30 years ago this year, Michael Horton and I began thinking about creating a radio show designed to help Christians better understand not only what they believe, but also why they believe it. This program would be rooted in the great truths of the Protestant Reformation and would feature guests and panelists from a variety of Christian traditions. The first White Horse Inn episode aired in the fall of 1990 on KKLA in Los Angeles, and now our program is heard on over 70 stations across the U.S. and Canada, as well as one station in the Philippines. Our weekly podcast is downloaded in over 200 countries and territories around the world, and we receive around 2 million downloads per year across all our platforms. For some time now, we've been releasing White Horse Inn classic episodes to our podcast feed every Wednesday, and to keep those shows coming, we need to curate, edit, and upload the shows, and cover all the associated download fees with our podcast server. As a thank you for your gift of any amount to help us with this work, we'll send you a link to download a special collection of classic episodes from the early years titled The American Religion. Simply head to whitehorseinn.org/WHI classics or call us at 1-800-890-7556. That's whitehorseinn.org/WHI classics or call us at 1-800-890-7556. Thanks so much for your support.
Welcome back to the White Horse Inn. I'm Michael Horton. We're talking about Romans chapter 10 in this program, dealing with Paul's concerns to unite zeal with knowledge. R.C., how would you respond to people who say, I don't want head knowledge, I want heart knowledge?
You know the old saying, the more I know him, the more I love him. And the more I learn about God, the more I can know him personally. I can't know anybody personally that I don't know anything about.
What about Paul's criticism that knowledge puffs up?
Well, knowledge can puff up. And again, the ultimate goal of knowledge is not knowledge itself. Knowledge is never an end of itself. And knowledge apart from zeal, knowledge apart from love, would lead to arrogance and aloofness and in fact can be a detriment if it's isolated from the heart. But we say in classical Reformed theology that there's a twofold primacy, and that may sound self-contradictory because you can only have one primacy, but you have a primacy with respect to order and a primacy with respect to importance. With respect to order, the primacy is the mind. As I said, you can't have it in the heart if you don't have it first in the mind. But the primacy of importance is the heart. The single most important thing is that our hearts are right with God. But that doesn't mean that we can get there apart from an understanding of who God is and what he teaches us in his word.
So you're not saying that knowledge saves us. We're not saved by what we know, but we can't be saved apart from knowing Christ.
Exactly right. Faith, I mean, an essential ingredient of faith is understanding. And you can't have understanding of something you know not of. I mean, we're not saved by faith in general. A lot of people think that. It doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you're sincere. Well, you know, you could sincerely believe in Satan. That isn't going to justify anybody. You have to have an object to your faith, and that object has to be Christ, and it has to be the biblical Christ.
What is the particular bit of information that Paul complains in Romans 10 that the Jews of his day were ignorant of?
I don't think they understood the grounds by which we are saved. The issue of how can an unjust person escape the judgment of God on Judgment Day. When I have to stand before a just God and I am not just, the only thing that will save me is righteousness. And if I don't have it myself, which I don't, then I got to get it somewhere. And the biblical message is that that righteousness is supplied by the perfect righteousness of Jesus, which is imputed or transferred or deemed, counted for all who put their trust in him.
Is this merely a Jewish problem?
I don't know of any issue in the church today that's more grave, more serious, more lasting consequences than the debate over imputation, a word that most evangelicals don't even know what it means. But there you're talking about the very heart and soul of the gospel itself.
We recently did a survey at the National Pastors Convention asking various questions related to the themes in the book of Romans. And would you believe that when asked about the word imputation, 67% were initially unfamiliar with the term?
Well, that the term evangelical is a misnomer in this day and age. How in the world can you be an evangelical? I've never heard the term imputation. But again, Mike, you know, I've seen these kinds of surveys again and again and again. You and I have talked to some of the most visible Christian leaders in our country and in our time who were just incapable of even giving a basal definition of the gospel. You ask them about the cross, and they'll say, well, Jesus died for my sins, but that's about it. And, the depth and the riches of the New Testament unveiling of all that is involved in that sacrificial work of Christ in which he satisfies the wrath of God in behalf of his people. The depths and riches of the atonement is the tragedy is that Christians think they know the cross, but they don't. And you remember the theme of the Reformation, post-Tenebras lux, after darkness light. But now the gospel has receded once more into the darkness. It's eclipsed, even in the so-called evangelical church. If you ask an ordinary self-proclaimed evangelical what the gospel is, they're saying, getting purpose for my life, having Jesus in my heart, having meaning to my existence, having a personal relationship with Jesus. Those are all nice things, but that's not the gospel. The gospel has a content of the person and work of Jesus, whose work is appropriated to us by faith and by faith alone.
We've been listening to R.C. Sproul. R.C., thank you very much for being with us on the White Horse Inn.
It's my pleasure, and give my love to everybody there, please.
You know, when we think of the objections that we hear most, it comes down to Romans 10, verse 1. It's the thing we hear over and over again. You guys are about getting all of your doctrinal ducks in a row, as if we're simply on a head trip here. We just want to bury people in facts or whatever.
Yeah, right. Nobody's living up to it. Nobody is.
Sociologists will tell you if you're gonna check empirically on members of churches across the board, it's all about equal if you're gonna measure sanctification.
Right.
Not much difference. But didn't Paul give this in a verse in Romans 1 that he was gonna talk about a righteousness not according to law?
Mm. Yeah.
Wasn't that in chapter 1?
Already. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's sort of an announcement of what I'm gonna do.
Yeah. And we, you know, when we think of the objections that we hear most, It comes down to Romans 10, verse 1. It's the thing we hear over and over again. You guys are about getting all of your doctrinal ducks in a row, as if we're simply on a head trip here. We just want to bury people in facts or whatever. Whereas what we are interested in is the heart and the hands. We want to see our young people with tears coming down their eyes, waving their hands at a Christian concert. We want to see
pure lives.
Pure lives. We want to see on Nightline young people committing their lives to chastity.
Right.
And now this is important work, and, and trying to stop AIDS, that's what the church is all about. And what Paul is saying is, no, those are all good things. Absolutely good things, but they're all law things. The thing that saves you, the story I've been trying to tell you about since chapter one, this story is not about you. It's not about what you will. It's not about what you decide. It's not about what you feel. It's not about what you do. It's about God and what he feels and what he's decided and what he's done.
Well, it's here's a clear call for category distinctions, because Paul will address the issue of works and our place and our responsibilities in the culture and in the church at a later point. Yep. But here the issue is, what gives you a right standing before God? And if you assume that your zeal as it relates to good works is what gives you a right standing before God, as we mentioned last week in the last chapter about your choosing God, if you think any of these things is what gives you a right standing before God, then you have sorely missed the point.
And let's remember, too, that the Pharisees here were not slackards.
No.
Paul's talking about a people. Look, their zeal is incredible. They were concerned with the ceremonial washings. They were concerned with dietary laws, the observance of feast days. They really thought that they were the Messianic kingdom had been manifest because they were going to ensure through their oral tradition that everything done in Israel was going to be done according to the law.
Philippians 3 says, look at me. I was so zealous, I persecuted the church.
So their zeal is incredible. And the zeal of the Pharisees has to exceed the zeal of most American evangelicals. I mean, we're talking about people that devoted every minute of every day to a ritual observance of oral tradition and thereby thinking that they were obeying the law.
If you find a coin on the street, you tithe, you include that in your tithes, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just it's incredible. So those are the people Paul's talking about. And he says their zeal does not account them as righteous.
Yeah.
So let's take the top 1%, the Mother Teresa's, you know, those who have manifested an incredible piety and who manifest it publicly, and the person that everyone emulates and desires to be like. Paul says that does not justify.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It may help your neighbor.
Yep.
Sure.
It may be a really wonderful thing for you to do. It may be a vocation to which God is calling you.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't the gospel.
And Mike, I want to return to this because I think this is such an unfair characterization on the part of non-Reformed Christians as it relates to those who are Reformed. The assumption that those who are concerned about doctrine are not concerned about righteousness, personal good deeds, to whatever extent, whether it's just in the church, in the family, in the community. That is so unfair. I think on both sides we do have a tendency to wrongly present the other side and maybe give extremes as if from our vantage point that those who are not Reformed are not concerned about doctrine. They are. It's just wrong doctrine. But I think
wrong practice
and wrong practice exactly. But I it's so unfair when you hear people assume because you are concerned about doctrinal precision that you're not concerned about godliness in the community and in the church and in charitable deeds.
Well, I think that's a great point. And I think if you're properly concerned about doctrine, you're going to see a different solution to the human problem.
Yes.
And so because we see a different solution to the human problem, which is a righteousness that comes from God and is received by faith, we're going to look for different ways of implementing change in the society. So when someone like Rick Warren looks at a Reformed church and says, well, they're small, they're not growing, they're not reaching out, it's because he's looking for kinds of things that fit with his egalitarian, prosperous, white Orange County kind of paradigm, Whereas we're talking about somebody seeing themselves as a sinner, seeing themselves in need of a justifying righteousness, mm-hmm. believing the proper things, and then being tied to a local congregation where the mm-hmm. word is preached, where they're catechized, where the sacraments are administered. And again, remember, Scripture ties outreach first to the local congregation, and yes. only then, once the needs of the local congregation are met, only then to those outside the church. And so because
And then it's more a matter of those who are members of the church functioning within the context of the culture, not yeah. doing it necessarily in the name of the church.
Exactly. Right. Great point.
Yeah, there's this assumption that the church equals the sum total of Christians. No, the church is an institution ordained for the purpose of delivering the gospel through word and sacrament. Christians are called to scads of vocations mm-hmm. right. that the church is not called to.
Yep.
So Christians can do all kinds of things. Ministers can do all kinds of things that are not part of the ministry of the church, per se. Now, we're not saying that knowledge without zeal is okay, are we?
No.
No.
Not at all.
No, it's a straw man.
But yeah, and that's what makes that argument so unfair, and we've heard it over and over again. This is what we need, and like I said, it's assuming in the first place that evangelicals are overly concerned about doctrine, and it just makes some dangerous assumptions.
Or that we're zealous. Again, looking yeah. at the statistics. Now, I mean, this is the same thing, too. Rome's critique has always been, well, if you believe this, you'll just go and send your daylights out.
That's Romans 6:1.
Yeah, it's Romans 6:1.
Exactly. And which is answered.
The irony of it all is the Rome that has said that has been a cesspool of idolatry and immorality for centuries.
And with a whole bunch of money to keep it going.
Yeah.
And quiet.
Now, so have our churches. Yeah. This is not a moral superiority thing. The question is, when a church really messes up, and it's not a question of when, but how often in a day, when a church or a person really messes up, how big is the grace there to cover that?
Uh-huh.
And Paul's answer is, where sin abounds, grace does much more abound. That's why the irony of it all is, if you start with God and His grace, you'll get a zeal that is called gratitude. If you start with you and your zeal, you'll not only not get the gospel and therefore confound the doctrine, get the doctrine all messed up, you will only have a zeal based on selfishness.
Did you know that you can help support the work of the White Horse Inn every time you purchase something at Amazon.com by using Amazon Smile? At no additional charge to you, Amazon will donate a small percentage of every transaction to the White Horse Inn when you link your account to Amazon Smile. Simply visit smile.amazon.com and enter White Horse Inc. That's White Horse INC. Then the next time you shop at smile.amazon.com, you'll be helping to support our work here at the White Horse Inn. Again, simply head to smile.amazon.com and enter White Horse Inc. Thanks for your support.